Good afternoon. How are we all doing? Good. Thank you so much for having me back, Dr. Rita Marie and team. I know it's very complicated. There's a lot of moving parts to put on conferences, so I'm very grateful to be here. I'm very grateful that you are all here, sitting down, which is nice. So we're going to talk about autophagy and fasting, but you know what? One of the best ways to enhance autophagy is, guess what? Movement, exercise. When you move your muscles, you stimulate autophagy. And I want to provide this context and caveat for people, and I'm going to say it over and over and over again, because on the internet at large, when you hear about autophagy, what's paired with it? Fasting. So many people now are fasting, and I love fasting. I fast all the time. I just broke my 28-hour fast around 11 a.m. this morning. Fasting is really important, and you heard earlier, you know, in Dr. Rita Marie's talk about how, you know, she's been doing intermittent fasting for a very long time. It does a wonderful job at driving down glucose, at driving down insulin, which, by the way, glucose and insulin inhibit autophagy. So when you fast hormonally, you create the metabolic milieu to not only burn more fat, but to kickstart this process called autophagy. What else drives down glucose and insulin? Moving your muscles. Moving your muscles is probably one of the, in conjunction with a low-carb, high-fat, whole-food derived diet, is one of the best ways to improve insulin sensitivity, okay? If any of you, and I highly recommend, who here is testing their blood glucose using Precision Extract? There's a bunch of different, you know, meters out there, Keto Coach, Keto Mojo. You'll find if after dinner, if you take a 10-minute walk, guess what happens to your glucose? Drops like a rock. I went to had a meal that was really high in carbohydrates when I was wearing a continuous glucose monitor. I've worn it off and on over the years. And my glucose levels were like 160 for me, which is really high. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm about to go to bed. This is way too high to be going to bed with a glucose of 160. I was thinking about all these advanced glycation end products that are going to occur and all this. I'm like, all right, I'm going to take my dogs for a walk. And literally my glucose dropped from 168 to like, it was like 84 in 10 minutes. It was incredible. Now I could see the 24, it dropped and then it rose again. That's why I love, if you're a nerd at all or want to know your body, go to your traditional doctor and get a prescription for a 24-hour glucose monitor. It will change how you eat, your stress management, your sleep, and of course, we're going to talk about autophagy as well today. So let's dive into it. A few disclaimers. Of course, we're not talking about treating, curing, or preventing any disease. I'm just sharing with you my research that I've done. I'll share with you why I'm so interested and fascinated with this. I do sell books. I have a supplement company. None of that is going to be talked about today. So when I was a little kid, I just loved learning about how things work. That was my thing. It was just really, this was my favorite book. That's me and my dad. We'd always take things apart, build stuff, you know, make trains and all these sort of things. So my passion for this has never changed. And my goal, what I feel like I'm here to do, is to share that with people like yourselves and other people. And that's why I make videos, travel to do interviews, things like that. I do have a couple pigs. This is Dimitri. This is Alfred. That's my dog, Rainier. It's pretty funny. So they're hogs, actually, and they were little hogs here. They're too big now to go take for walks, but it was really funny seeing the dogs and the pigs run together out in the forest when it was snowing. It was pretty cool. So I'm kind of a nerd at home, but I already hinted at this. Fasting is not the only path to enhance autophagy. Exercise. We're going to talk about hormones. We're going to talk about circadian rhythms. And we're going to talk about how when you're in a state of ketosis, that metabolic pathway is congruent and synergistic with triggering this autophagy process as well. Even the process of breaking down body fat, lipophagy, what you're going to learn about is autophagy. We think it's just one thing. There's a lot of subtypes and specialization. There's 26 different forms of autophagy. Okay, so it gets really actually complicated, but we're going to make it simple today. All right, so we hinted on this. Here's the molecular biology of exercise and how it affects autophagy. You're not going to memorize this, which is totally fine. I know there are some folks that love the science, and you do have access to these slides, by the way. And if you are so inclined to share this on social media, just tag me and the Shine19 hashtag so we can share the science with other people. But I just want you to focus on one thing. And this is a big take-home, takeaway. The reason why exercise is an autophagy enhancer is because when you're exercising, you create what? Physical damage. Who's been sore after they've been working out? Guess how that soreness is repaired? Hint, it's autophagy mediated, okay? So for those of you that are trying to figure out, well, how many hours do I fast? How many days do I need to fast to enhance autophagy? Okay, well, you can pontificate the optimal amount to fast, and a lot of, we will do this probably for the next 100 years, but you can also just say, well, in the meantime, I'm going to exercise, and I'm going to get a little sore. Who here's game with that? I know it's painful. Yes, a lot of you, majority of in the room, raise your hand, which is really cool. So if you don't know, we don't know what heart rate, we don't know exact intensity you should be exercising, but as long as the next day you're like, ah, I feel it. I feel it in my back. I feel it in my legs. I did something. That physical damage that you created within the muscular tissue, that is being repaired by way of autophagy. Cool. So now you can share something about autophagy with your spouse and say, hey, honey, this is why you need to get in the gym, right? So here we go. Okay, there's two summary slides. I do like to just throw these up there so people can take pictures and have them on their phone. We're going to unpack all this right now, so I don't expect, I'm not going to read this off verbatim. I think that's boring when seminars do that, but I just like to put this off there up here so that you have an idea of all the summaries that we're going to unpack. So let's just dive into what this process is. A lot of people talk about autophagy as though it's Pac-Man degrading cells. That's actually not totally accurate. Autophagy is an intracellular phenomenon. Intracellular phenomenon. And I was looking for some, well, you know what? I have a microphone so I can move around. So check this out. All right, so we're going to go over here. And does this screw up the camera guy? Maybe a little bit. But let's just pretend this table right here of dirty dishes. Can everyone see that? Okay, you have trillions of these little things in your body called cells. Inside your cells, you have many organs called organelles. Who has a favorite organelle? I love mitochondria, Golgi apparatus, endoplasmic reticulum. Autophagy helps to degrade those dysfunctional organelles. When it's time, for example, it's like cleaning the dishes, okay? So autophagy is like a busboy. It's taking those, the mitochondria, the endoplasmic reticulum, all the complicated cellular organelles that are hard to, you know, say, and it's degrading them so they can be utilized to make new ones. It's also degrading aggregated proteins, okay? Now, this process is happening in all of us, probably right now, even though you just ate a few hours ago. Basal levels of autophagy in pretty much every single cell are occurring all the time. The levels increase when your energy goes down, okay? So if you don't eat anything right now for the rest of the day, and you wake up at 8 in the morning, your autophagy level in your liver, in your kidney, in your pancreas, in your fat tissue, in your muscle tissue will be amplified. Does that make sense? Because what your cells are really doing is saying, hey, look, we got some aggregated proteins, we got some dirty dishes, we can break those down to create energy. So it's a process of catabolism. And so what you're gonna see on here is most of the activators of autophagy are also catabolic mediators. Thyroid hormone, what does it do? It breaks stuff down, creates energy. Glucagon, what does it do? When we have our low blood sugar, glucagon helps to create blood sugar from anew. It also helps to kickstart autophagy. All these different, you know, circadian rhythms, cortisol. I know cortisol has like a mixed, you know, people have different opinions on cortisol. But if you're fasting or you're keto, cortisol is actually your friend, okay? I'm not saying that you should have high levels of cortisol all the time, but little pulses of cortisol helps you with autophagy, okay? The other thing that's really important, and this is big take-home number two that I hope you remember, is autophagy helps break down aggregated proteins. And for some of you, you're like, what the hell is an aggregated protein? I understand. But if we think about neurologic disorders, beta amyloid, we think about Parkinson's, we think about Huntington's disease, these diseases where there's accumulation of dysfunctional aggregated proteins, particularly within the central nervous system, that's where autophagy is most helpful. Okay? Now, here's a little pro tip. As we get older, autophagy starts to decline, like everything else, unfortunately. Okay? So is fasting more important for children or the elderly? The elderly, right? And so this is when you have your client who's 20-something and says, hey, I want to enhance autophagy. It's like, well, you probably don't have an autophagy deficiency if you're already lean, right? If someone maybe has, they've been eating every 2 to 3 hours for their entire life. They've been snacking, having a lot of protein shakes, not giving the gut a rest. They might have a deficiency of sorts in autophagy. But it's really a function of age. And as we age, it becomes harder for our body to clear out the cellular junk. We accumulate more junk. You ever seen the TV show Hoarders? You're like, whoa, your living room looks like that? It didn't happen overnight. They never cleaned it up. Now, if you could make that parallel with the TV show Hoarders, a lot of people, their livers look like the equivalent of a hoarder. There's excessive accumulated fat, who's heard of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, right? It's estimated that that's going to be the next disease, in addition to Alzheimer's and other type 2 diabetes, that is going, there's going to be such a high demand for liver transplants. I don't know the stats, but it's pretty staggering. So here's just a small tip. We're not going to talk too much about biomarkers, because remember, autophagy is extracellular or intracellular? Intracellular. How do you measure stuff within the cell? It's very hard, right? You can't. So that's why people are like, where's the test to look at autophagy? You're like, well, how do you look inside your cell? Like, you can look at mRNA, you can do genome-wide association tests, you can do these things, but that's why it's so hard to measure exactly what's going on. So what scientists do is they look at these autophagy initiation proteins. And you're going to see, and we're going to talk a little bit about it, LC3, I'm not seeing it here, this uncle-like 2 and all that. So what researchers will do is take biopsies and look at these. That's how they ascertain how much exercise or how much fasting or low-carb or high-fat, et cetera, how does that affect autophagy? All right. Now, the thing that's also important, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself on the slides, which is totally fine. There's this little, and believe me, this is a scientific word, I'm not making this up, this invagination of the cell membrane that basically grabs all this junk. So your damaged mitochondria, your damaged organelles, your misfolded proteins, you're creating a cell membrane within the cell, okay? What are your cell membranes made of? Fat, phospholipids, essential fats. Okay? So can someone eating a McDonald's junk food diet enhance autophagy optimally if they fast? Probably not, right? It would be because literally, if you're upregulating autophagy through time-restricted feeding, intermittent fasting, and exercise, you're making a bunch of these little cells within your cell. So micronutrients, good sources of fat become very, very important. Now, I don't have randomized placebo-controlled trials to point to exactly how much phospholipids and essential fats that one needs, but a good test, a barometer of your cell membrane health is what? Omega-3 index. Who's done the omega quant? Exactly. I was really disappointed with my omega quant because I stopped taking fish oil for a while, and we eat, grass-fed and have chickens and this and that. My omega-3 index was 5.8. which is like just below what's considered kind of where you don't want to be, okay? So it's kind of like, I think it's the omega-3 index is almost like vitamin D in the sense that so many people are deficient. And this, what's cool about this, it's a $49 test, non-invasive. It's a finger prick just like the glucose test. The omega quant, and I have no financial affiliation with the company. If you have another company that you like, I just know this gentleman, Bill Harris, has done a lot of research on this. That can be something that you might want to look at for clients because, again, if they have really rigid cell membranes, deficient in omega-3s, how do we expect this fluidity, to be transferred in the cell to create this autophagy process? So we're going to dive into that. So there's a lot of interest in autophagy. Clearly, a lot of you are fascinated by this. I look at Google Trends. I remember seeing when the ketogenic diet, and I started, kind of talking about it on YouTube in 2014 because the demand, I could kind of see the demand, but yet the client, the practitioners were not totally sold on it because a lot of practitioners in med school were taught about diabetic ketoacidosis. And I think there was some confusion, at least initially, wait, is ketosis nutritional ketosis? How is that different from diabetic ketoacidosis? And we're going to get into ketosis shortly. Even though there's a lot of interest now in 2019, this is not a new concept. You guys read 1859 was the first time that autophagy was actually kind of quantified in the scientific literature by this individual who studied sailors who would be able to go for very long periods of time without food. And the scientist was like, well, how are they living off this? And he figured out that it was autophagy mediated. So let's just get into some basic definitions. What does it mean? Autophagy, self-eating. You're eating yourself, okay? So remember, autophagy is characterized by a catabolic environment. When nutrients are low, when food is low, when we're in a low state, which can occur, again, by time-restricted feeding, which we'll define shortly, intermittent fasting, and also exercise. Because look, when you're exercising, what are you doing? You're depleting glycogen. You're depleting glucose. right? You're breaking stuff down, which is beneficial. So that's what autophagy is. Here's a buddy of mine who actually is no longer with us. His name's Marcus. He unfortunately passed away with cancer. He's a friend of mine in high school. He became this just wildly successful DJ. And we worked together as busboys back in 2015. So again, I already kind of created the analogy of, you know, what you know what a busboy does. Busboys clean tables, right? Tables are round, kind of like your cells are round. And we've all been to yucky restaurants or something where the table's kind of dirty and they didn't bust the table and you're like, oh man, I don't know if I want to eat here, honey. Let's go somewhere else. Well, unfortunately, a lot of us have dirty tables, dirty cells, okay? The conditions are all the conditions that come to mind of the top, you know, five chronic diseases, you know, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, autoimmunity, neurologic disorders. All these, autophagy is this unifying mechanism that connects all these seemingly separate diseases. Isn't that pretty fascinating? So if you look at the research, there's a whole litany of research on diabetes and autophagy. And in within the pancreas, there's dysfunctional autophagy within the pancreas, dysfunctional autophagy in the liver, even in cancer as well. So really fascinating stuff. So again, what we're trying to help you do today is learn tools so that your cells, your family's member cells, and your client cells don't look like this. Okay, so here's just a question. Just ask yourself, like, let's take an honest assessment. Because again, do we have tests for autophagy that are commercially available, yes or no? We don't, because it's intracellular. So this is what you need to ask in your client intake when you're working with clients. How long, Sally Smith, have you been eating every 2 to 3 hours? Right, doing these different diets, right? I admit I did this because this is what the bodybuilding magazines where I learned nutrition back when I was 14 years old said to do. You have to stimulate muscle protein synthesis every 2 to 3 hours. You have to have slow digesting whey casein before you go to bed, all this stuff. A lot of you in this room and probably your clients did this. So how long did you do this? That will determine probably your the pendulum of how, you know, deficient or devoid your autophagy mechanisms are. How long have you been physically active or sedentary? If you've been someone has been sedentary for 20 years, not creating that demand to their muscle tissue, you know, we don't have the test yet, but we can probably say with a high degree of confidence that they have an autophagy deficiency of sorts. Does that make sense? You know, how long have someone been snacking? And we're going to dive into circadian rhythms. And I already kind of alluded to, if you stopped eating right now and you didn't eat anything until 8 a.m. tomorrow, your autophagy within your muscle, your liver, and your pancreas would be very high, okay? Because you haven't had food. And autophagy is actually highest in the morning. So I know we hear you break your fast, and we're going to, I'm a fan of early time-restricted feeding, but you don't want to, like, the first thing you do, wake up and have a protein shake, like the magazines say, okay? Go for a little walk, get outside, get some sunshine, create that hunger pressure before you actually break the fast. Because that feeling of hunger, that ghrelin and that hormonal shift is actually a sign that this autophagy is actually increasing from the hormonal standpoint. So just, you know, want you to understand that autophagy is most active in the morning and when we're sleeping. So what happens if your clients are not sleeping well? Probably not getting good levels of autophagy. And we know that from an epidemiological perspective, people that get short change on their sleep, shift workers, unfortunately nurses and healthcare practitioners that are doing great things for people, what sort of diseases do they have later in life? Cancer, neurologic disorders, autoimmunity, diabetes, and so forth. All those conditions, by the way, are also linked to what? Autophagy. Pretty fascinating. Okay, so I just wanted you to remember, autophagy is not this Pac-Man stuff, because I see YouTube videos where people are talking about autophagy, like, oh, it's where cells engulf other cells, and it's like, it's not that, it's intracellular. So it's kind of semantics, but I just want you to understand that. There's different subtypes of autophagy, we're not going to get into that at all. Microautophagy, macroautophagy, mitoautophagy, all this sort of thing, we're not going to get into that. You know, mostly, when you read about autophagy, when you hear about dysfunctional autophagy, they're referring to macroautophagy. Macroautophagy. And here's what's really unique, and we're going to hear more about this. You know, this is the autophagosome complex put together. So here's what's really kind of fascinating if you're a nerd, kind of like me. We hear so much about autophagy and it's getting all the play, but you know who's really doing the work? The lysosomes. Who knows what, or who's ever heard of a lysosome? A few good students here, right? Because they're not getting the action. They're not getting the airtime. But really, what's going on is you have this bag of stuff. Remember that cell membrane from the phospholipids, from a healthy diet and omega-3s. You got some aggregated protein. You got, say, a dysfunctional mitochondria. You got some damaged junk. The lysosome is like a bag of, it's like a Swiss Army knife. The lysosome is going to degrade all that stuff, and it's going to send the amino acids to stimulate muscle protein synthesis. It's going to use those fats to, say, enhance ketogenesis. It's going to use the cell membranes and so on. So it's really, from an intellectual standpoint, it's kind of fun to talk about it, but it's really the lysosomes that are doing all the action. So just another small fun fact for your friends for wine tonight over dinner. So remember, we talked about phospholipids. Phospholipids are very important. Does anyone know what that is? It's not chocolate. It's liver, okay? So I know not too many people are fans of eating organ meats, and they're gross, and they're ew, and they're this and that, but if you want to get your stores of phospholipids elevated, periodic liver, I think, is a great thing. Of course, animal wellness is very important, pasture-raised, grass-fed, hormone-free, etc., but periodic consumptions, I think it's hard to make the argument that our ancestors did not consume periodic organ meats, and organ meats are a great source of phoscholine, which is absolutely necessary for this autophagy process. So just wanted to throw that out there. If you don't eat liver and you're comfortable having eggs, egg yolks are another source. And then that ties in, and we're not going to get any more into it other than this picture, methylation, the methylation cycle, methylation support. So individuals that have 5-MTHFR and various genetic single nucleotide polymorphisms in their methylation cycle, they could be candidates for extra support if they're interested in enhancing autophagy, because if you look here, the methylation cycle is paired and baked right into this phospholipid and choline biosynthesis cycle, right? So again, we have to look at the whole picture. It's not just like, hey, I fasted today for 24 hours. Like, there's more to it than that. We need to just keep that in mind. So here's this lysosome. It has over 50 different enzymes. Again, so you got junky stuff. You got this cellular membrane, essentially, that's forming to get all the stuff, and the lysosome, it's basically like a garbage disposal. It's going to chop it all up very specifically and send the stuff out so that it can be utilized, either to create energy or to recreate what was previously damaged cell membrane components and things like that. You know, I don't have a slide on it, but what's really interesting, I always like to add new stuff to presentations and things. Was anyone at KetoCon here in Austin? Yes, okay, good. Because I did a similar presentation, but I added new stuff, and I just didn't want to, like, bore anyone. But what's really interesting is when we get inflamed, okay, so if we have inflammation or intestinal permeability or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth or mold or these chronic infections, autophagy actually pivots and starts breaking down and causing mitochondrial dysfunction. It's like a pathogenic kind of response. It's like a misdirected response. And so you might want to consider individuals. You know, if say they're like, man, I'm fasting, I'm eating keto, I'm doing all these things, but the weight's not coming off or my blood sugar's not improving, you might want to start looking at these subtle infections and what else could be going on in the gut or in their environment. Because there's some animal model studies to show that when there is inflammation present, and this particular study looked at lipopolysaccharide or endotoxin, which all of you have in your gut right now, but you're safe because you have a good gut barrier, when that stuff comes across, it dysregulates autophagy and causes your mitochondria to be dysfunctional. So this is hot new research that just actually came out, so I wanted to share that with you. Okay, so let's talk about gas pedals and brakes. All of you drive in this room, or at least probably know how to drive. So we're going to talk about the brakes of autophagy is mTOR, mechanistic target of rapamycin. Okay, mTOR kind of has a bad name sometimes, but it's kind of like a garbage disposal. It's neither bad nor good. It's bad if you stick your hand in it, but it's not good if you need to clean stuff out of your sink. mTOR is good after you eat a meal. Remember, after you eat a meal, you're in an anabolic environment. You have growth factors. You have insulin. You have nutrients around. That's not when autophagy is most upregulated. It's when you're fasting or exercise. And when we start to fast, so again, tomorrow morning, if you don't eat for the rest of the day, AMPK is going to be high. Adenosine monophosphate kinase, it's just an enzyme. It's a big, long-named enzyme. When you exercise, when you compress your feeding window, when you take nutritional compounds like berberine hydrochloride, when you take metformin, you upregulate this thing called AMPK. And that drives autophagy. That's the autophagy gas pedal. What's the autophagy brake? mTOR is the brake. AMPK is the gas pedal. It's kind of easy to think about if you're like, wait, what is that? AMPK, autophagy. It's like, okay, that's you know, earlier in the alphabet. A is earlier in the alphabet than M. That's what initiates it. mTOR inhibits it, okay? Here's what's interesting, too, and our grandmother has probably told you and told me this, too. You know, when you're sick, honey, what do? Don't eat or have a little soup, right? You don't have, like, a big, you know, 1,200-calorie meal, right? You fast. Well, it turns out that part of what autophagy and fasting does is it helps to clear out pathogens from our cells in our body. So if your clients are ever like, oh, my gosh, I'm feeling sick, what can I do? You know, there's vitamin D, there's different, you know, herbs and all these things you can throw at them. But remind them, hey, you probably should just fast. And what do kids normally do when they're feeling sick? They don't want to eat, right? It's kind of funny. And same with dogs. They lose their appetite. Same with pets. Just adult humans are like, oh, I need to get my protein in. I need my egg yolks. I need, you know, all this sort of stuff. So anyway, we need to keep in mind that this is another process that autophagy clears out pathogens. And a lot of us do this naturally anyway. That's why we don't have a huge appetite mostly when we're sick. So we already kind of hinted at this, but here's a picture that I was alluding to earlier. Autophagy is involved in kind of the early differentiation of humans and multicellular organisms like human beings and animals and things like that. And then it's also, you know, the levels of which are high and beneficial. And we tend, as we age, essentially, there's an impetus to drive autophagy through fasting and exercise because our endogenous levels of autophagy decline as we age, just like many other things. And it could be hormonally mediated. It could be because overnutrition. It could be lack of drive to the muscle from exercise. So, again, the client that calls you that's 20-something years old or whatever, autophagy is not the biggest concern, at least for me initially when I would be, you know, having a conversation with that person. But someone who's 72, 73, 50, you know, over the age of, say, 45, it might be more, you know, more of an impetus. They might, that person, I would say over 40, not that 40 is old by any means, I'm not saying that, but that would be a situation where it's like, you know what, like Rita Marie was saying earlier, Dr. Rita Marie, like, you know, fasting just for 12 hours is what normal humans should be doing, right? That's it. Like, that's easy, going from dinner to breakfast. But as you get older, you should kind of put a priority on fasting for longer periods of time on a daily level. I personally do, you know, 16 to 18 hours of fasting pretty much every day. Unless it's like on a weekend, family's in town, we're going to go out to brunch, you know, I don't want to be the weird guy having water and things like that, right? So you got to work in your social life. But, you know, having these hard stops around when we eat and when we feed can be very helpful. And you're going to hear later on about the emotional connection to food and how fasting can be helpful. And there's a double-edged sword there. But just really want to stress this fourth main important point that we need to be more vigilant about fasting and exercise as we age, because naturally autophagy is downregulated and becomes the mechanisms. I've been trying to dive into this. Why is this? Why is it that autophagy declines as we age? And it seems that these autophagy initiation proteins that kickstart the whole process, they become desensitized, almost resistant. And so we need to add more stimulation. Okay, how are we doing on time? 30 minutes, all right. So we already kind of talked about, you know, again, here's kind of a nerdy picture for all of you, but what happens when we have dysfunctional autophagy? We have cells that look like there's a bunch of junk in them. We have aggregated proteins, dysfunctional organelles, and so on. And so what does that mean for your clients? That means diabetes, obesity, cancer, heart disease. All these diseases that we're seeing of are a disease of dysfunctional autophagy at some level. And so it's kind of, this was a joke, you know, oh, autophagy is so simple, you just fast, but there's actually a lot of different subtypes. Agrophagy, mitophagy, peroxophagy, lipophagy, right? It's very nuanced. And I throw this in there because some people say, oh, you know, my mother-in-law or something has cancer, and so she's doing like a, you know, 30-day fast. Like, she's just trying to ramp up autophagy as much as you want. And I'm not saying that's a good or bad idea for every situation. Every situation in clinical person's biochemistry is different. But what you need to understand is in certain cancers, autophagy is upregulated to evade the immune system. So more is not always better. Does that make sense? There's a U-shaped curve. I just want to throw that out there. And so for your clients who are doing a lot of fasting all the time, because once people start fasting, I admit it can be kind of addictive. you know, you create these, you know, arousal type hormones, orexin A, you know, norepinephrine, adrenaline, and so people can kind of get wrapped up into it. But doing prolonged fast back to back very frequently, I want to caution people and say, you know, that I don't think that's, unless you have a disease that warrants it or a health condition that warrants it, that's not all, more is not always better. Does that kind of make sense? It's intuitive, but I'd just like to throw that out there. So the connections between autophagy and ketosis, this is really fascinating. So as you heard earlier, one of the best ways to get into ketosis is what? Fasting. Right. So when we fast, I'll just give you a quick, you're going to hear about keto throughout the weekend. And so I think if you hear it from different people, it might stick a little bit more. You know, fasting is largely a hormonal-mediated phenomenon, meaning that you create this hormonal recipe, and that creates the liver, that initiates the liver to synthesize or make ketones, which is called ketogenesis, synthesizing ketones. So insulin needs to be high or low. Low insulin, glucose to make ketones should be high or low. Low. Glucagon should be high or low to make ketones. High. Low glucose, low insulin, high glucagon. Okay? If you could create a pill that did that, people wouldn't need to take exogenous ketones because their liver would naturally make ketones. Well, guess what? Those same hormones, guess what they do? In that ratio, low glucose, low insulin, high glucagon. I actually have a picture right here. I'll show it to you. That stimulates autophagy as well, right? So these processes, and this is a like kind of a proof of concept paper that looked at this, you know, showing that the processes that are required to make ketones are autophagy mediated, just like with exercise, okay? So the point that I'm trying to convey here, the take home, point number five, I'm losing track now, the big take home number five is if you're trying to figure out, man, am I upregulating autophagy or are my clients upregulating autophagy? Well, you know, if they're starting to lose body fat and if their glucose is staying low and their ketones are rising, we can't look peek inside the cell. We can look extracellularly and look at ketones and glucose, and we can triangulate and infer that they're probably getting decent autophagy initiation from that environment. Again, low glucose and high ketones. And that naturally happens with exercise, with fasting, and eating a low-carb, high-fat style diet. Any questions? How's the pace? Good? Okay, good. All right, just want to check in. Here's a cool slide for the nerds. You know, what happens is lipophagy, the process of lipophagy, which is a subset of autophagy, is splitting down the stored lipids in your adipocytes when glucose and insulin are low and glucagon is high, and liberating those free fatty acids, which then go to the liver. And here's really why ketones are made, because free fats can't get into and cross the blood-brain barrier. I'll say it again. So we have a bunch of stored fat on our body fat. When glucose, insulin is low, glucagon's high, adrenaline is high, when we exercise or when we fast, we're liberating all this fat. The problem is your brain can't utilize it directly. That's why ketones exist. That's literally kind of the mechanism and the impetus researchers kind of look at teleologically. Like, why does the liver make ketones? And if we think about what ketones are, they're basically, we have all these long-chain fats, oleic acid, myristic acid, lauric acid, you know, all this stuff. You have this process of beta oxidation within your mitochondria where you're basically condensing all these fats to make acetyl-CoA, okay? Both glucose and both lipids can make acetyl-CoA. All a ketone is two molecules of acetyl-CoA. So if you wanted to like really make a ketone, you could take take olive oil, an enzyme, snip it down, and then just link together these acetyl-CoAs and you would have a ketone. Your liver does that. Your liver can make north of 120 grams of ketones per day. And I say that because a lot of people are like, wait, I just need this exogenous ketone supplement to get into ketosis. And I say, well, look, if you create the proper hormonal milieu, guess what? Your liver can make 10 times more than you're going to get in this supplement. I'm not anti-supplement. I have a supplement company. But I just like people to know that your liver can do this when you give it the right tools. 120 plus grams of ketones per day. And those ketones then can cross the blood-brain barrier, and that acetyl-CoA can be utilized in the mitochondria. Does that make sense? So it's very simple. So just wanted to kind of share that with you guys and gals. And just remember, this is a hormonal-mediated phenomenon. It's not a calorie phenomenon. I know we get into a lot of like conversations on Instagram and things because there's these two schools of camp, right? Calories in, calories out versus a hormone camp. You know, the process of making ketones is really hormonally mediated. Hormones are very important. Okay, let's keep on rocking and rolling. And, you know, what's so unique about all these compressed feeding patterns, whether it's alternate day fasting, whether it's 16-8 fasting, whether it's a fasting mimicry diet, the kind of common thread with all these is low glucose and high ketones, okay? That's kind of the common thread. So when your clients come to you and say, you know, practitioner, gosh, I really don't know what the best fasting protocol is. I've tried this one, I've tried that one, I'm not really sure. Well, you need to have them start testing and figure out which one is the best one for their own body. Because just because some guru who's popular on Instagram or whatever says, this is the thing that you should do, that doesn't mean that it's going to work for everyone, right? My wife, for example, she's a little bit older than me. She has a stronger family history of cancer. She just eats one meal a day. That's it. When I try to do that, I don't like how I personally feel. I start to notice I'm weaker. Maybe it's a better longevity play, but I feel like the best diet is a diet that helps you feel vibrant and strong, not tired and weak. So that's just my personal approach. So I eat two meals a day, and it works for me. So it's like we all need to tinker and test with this. And what's interesting is our diet and our feeding windows are going to change with the season, right? Because the seasons change. Our microbiome changes. Our hormones change with the season. And so just want you to understand that these are the type of diets. And, you know, there are some benefits to periodic long-term fasting as well. So this is just what I personally do, because a lot of people do ask, and I'm not an expert in this area. I just have been studying it for the past 4 years. What I do is I make it very simple. Every Monday, I fast for at least 24 hours. Okay, I just call it Metabolic Monday. We have a hashtag on Instagram. It's free. Anyone can do it. Here's the benefits of that, is all the stimulatory neurotransmitters that you're going to get from fasting, orexin A, noradrenaline, adrenaline, are going to help you have an awesome start to your week. Momentum begets more momentum. Progress begets more progress. So if you have a crappy Monday, you're thinking, when is this week over? I just want to get out of here. Like, I don't want to work anymore. I don't want to build my business. But if you have a rocking Monday, you can then have a rocking Tuesday and a rocking week. And I, you know, it can be hard to, if you've been, you know, you hung over or something, you had a crazy weekend, Monday can really kind of suck for some people. And a lot of your clients, that can be their world, their identity. And if you just say, hey, look, just don't eat it. Just make that your one day a week where you fast. Sunday night, have an early dinner, say 5 p.m., cut it off, and you'll have a rocking start to your week. And it's a natural way to increase productivity and focus and just to start to create this hormonal shift. And then what I personally do, because it's just very simple, every time there's a change in season, I fast for 3 days, 72 hours. So it's very simple. It's like fall's coming. It's the first day of fall. You're like, oh yeah, that's when I should fast for three days. Very simple, 72 hours. So that's what I personally do. I'm not saying you need to do that, but it's just I found that to be very simple, and you're doing a little bit of consistency every week. So here's the thing. If we think about autophagy and the mechanisms, they're adaptive just like exercise. And I think the more consistent, let me ask you a question. You have two people. One person does one marathon a year. One person does 2 miles, you know, a running event every month. Who's going to be more fit year-round? The person that's running consistently, not just... So the point that I'm trying to convey here is if you just do one big, say, 21-day fast, you're like, all right, I'm so committed. I'm going to do a water-only fast for 21 days. You know, I'm going to drop my risk of cancer. I'm going to do all that. And then what? You just go back to a normal diet? Right? What I mean, you might get some short-term relief for that, but what I'm trying to convey to you is AMPK and the mTOR and the hormones that are all affecting autophagy, we get those adaptations occur through exercise, and we know that people that stay lean and fit year-round, they don't just train for spring break. They don't just train for this work party. They're training every day or 5 days a week. And so I think being a little bit more regular and consistent is going to keep these processes primed. Does that make sense? I don't have a randomized placebo-controlled trial to verify this. This is just common sense and intuition, so just wanted to share that. We've already talked about this. For some reason, when I build presentations, I'm like, I need more slides. And now I'm like, well, I already talked about this. So more is not always better, okay? You already know that. Here's kind of the underlying mechanisms and chronic mTOR overexpression. Let's just kind of unpack this one because I think it's really good. mTOR, again, is kind of like cortisol, right? Depends on who you ask. Like, some people say, oh my gosh, cortisol, it's so bad. You're like, well, really? How would you function throughout the day if you did not have any cortisol? Chronic hypercortisolemia is bad. Cortisol high in the evening is bad, but we want cortisol first thing in the morning. Remember, cortisol helps to create glucose. It helps it to burn fat. When you exercise, guess what happens to cortisol? It elevates. So we can't say cortisol is always bad. And some people say, oh, mTOR is bad. It's linked with cancer. You want to suppress mTOR. It's the same thing. Chronic mTOR overexpression is bad. Periodic pulses of mTOR is needed to cause growth factors to be elevated and so forth, right? And so in a lot of people with these different, you know, diseases, and this is, you know, talking about, you know, heart disease and congestive heart failure and obesity, a lot of people never, mTOR is chronically expressed because their glucose is high, their insulin is high, they're sedentary, they're eating and snacking all the time. They're having a lot of, you know, protein and carbohydrates and imbalanced macronutrient ratios. So in that situation, mTOR is high because you're having all the pro-growth. And so you do see visceral adiposity. You see increases in belly fat. You see fat deposition within the liver, okay? So in the post-meal window, if you eat the healthiest meal that you think, you know, has some balanced protein, it has a little bit of carbs, maybe some fat, things like that, guess what's going to happen? mTOR is going to rise. We want to welcome that. When you break your fast, mTOR is going to rise as well. It's not a bad thing. You just don't want it, you know, chronically elevated. So I think, is anyone here in touch with or know about microdosing psilocybin or mushrooms and things like that? So some of you, this is kind of becoming more and more popular by executives and CEOs and things along those ends. I think a lot of us will be microdosing the drug that inhibits mTOR called rapamycin in the next 5 years. I could be crazy for making that claim, but there's a compound called rapamycin, and it's actually utilized in very high dosages to help increase the success of a tumor a tissue transplantation, right? Because it suppresses the immune system. So very high doses of mTOR inhibition, you know, suppress the immune system so that the chances of, say, getting a finger or an arm or a liver or a kidney transplanted that the immune system will not attack it. That's the intended use of the drug, but very low doses of the drug, like 2 milligrams a week, has been shown and studied in elderly individuals that are at risk for Alzheimer's, in dogs that are at risk for congestive heart failure to be healthy. So I literally think in the next few years, a lot of us will be pulsing, you know, rapamycin, which is pretty crazy. Okay, so let's play a little fun here. We have some scales, okay? So remember, we have the gas pedal, AMPK, we have the brake. Okay, this is controlling autophagy, this is controlling levels of anabolism and catabolism in your body. Okay, yeah, what mTOR does is it builds stuff. After you eat a meal, your metabolism collectively is trying to build stuff. It's trying to build glycogen, build long-chain fat stores in your adipocytes, trying to repair things, you know, and so forth. And when you're in a low energy state, your body's trying to break stuff down. It's not really harmful, it's trying to break down glycogen, which is stored glucose, trying to break down long-chain fats into those acetyl-CoAs that we talked about to make energy. Your body's trying to break down glucose to make energy, okay? My clicker's it's just that the computer's slow. Where'd our slides go? Oh, man, Mike. All right, okay. So just quick game, right? So you just ate a meal, mTOR's high, how's autophagy going to be? It's going to be inhibited. You don't need to tear down your cells and your you know, proteins and things like that in the post-meal window. Your body's trying to build things. This is warranted. This is okay. But when you start fasting, so there's no need to self-eat, as this little diagram shows you. But when you're fasting, energy is low. Your body's trying to recreate cellular energy, trying to break down that stored glucose and those lipids. So AMPK is going to be elevated. mTOR is going to be inhibited. So we want this yin and yang. This is the purpose of me kind of sharing this with you. Is we don't always want one or the other, we want a healthy balance, right? And I say this because I hear on the internet, you know, someone will leave a comment on my YouTube channel, for example, and say, oh my gosh, you had whey protein? Whey protein spikes insulin. Don't you know that insulin is bad? And I'm saying, well, I want to raise insulin or have a little raise in the post-workout window. It helps replenish glycogen. It helps with repair, right? So we have to understand the context. So I just wanted to reinforce that a little bit there. It's this chronicity. When we have the chronic elevations, that there's problematic issues. Okay, so let's get into, you know, the human studies when it comes to autophagy. Here's the thing that I want to leave you with, because we're not going to remember every single slide in every single study. The more physically fit you are when you fast, the more enhanced autophagy is. Okay. I want to say that again because I'm going to share with you the actual studies. So let's see here. This is the actual study. So researchers and this group has done a few different studies. They looked at autophagy initiation factors in elderly individuals who were sedentary and physically fit people who were fairly lean. And they fasted them for 36 hours and then quantified the difference in baseline until after 36 hours. And they found that there was just a small little bump in autophagy in the individuals who were overweight and sedentary and a massive increase in the individuals who were lean. So I say this because sometimes in the ketogenic space and online, I see a lot of people underemphasizing the importance of movement and activity. And I just want you to leave this with this take-home message, because I know a lot of you are going to be inspired to fast. I want you to think about, fasting's great, but you also need to exercise. You also need to exercise. The more physically fit you are, the more you will get out of your fast. The more physically fit you are, the more benefits and the more ROI you will get from your fast. I don't know. I mean, if that doesn't motivate you to exercise, I'm not sure what really will. And so a lot of you are thinking, well, I don't like exercise. And I say to people, find the exercise that you like, that you get a flow state from. I like lifting weights. You might like yoga. Some of you might like running on a trail. Do whatever gets you out of bed and gets you excited. And look, I'll tell you, I mean, I've been lifting weights since I was 14 years old, so close to, 23 years. And I'll tell you, like, there's days that I don't want to exercise because I'm tired or whatever. But you know what you do? You do it anyway, right? For those of you that are parents that had children that are hungry or sick or whatever, you're like, I don't want to get up and breastfeed. I don't want to get up and, wipe a poopy diaper. But you're a parent. It's your job. You do it anyway. So if you don't feel like exercising, you just make it a habit. You play tricks with your mind. And just say, hey, look, I know, I don't want to exercise today, but if I don't exercise, I'm not going to be impacting my autophagy. I want to be here as a grandparent. I want to be here as a business owner. I want to be here as an influencer to my clients and my folks. So just play little tricks with your mind and convince yourself, about exercising and so forth. Let's see. There's a few other studies here about protein I do want to get into, because a lot of people do ask about protein and autophagy, because they've heard that protein, and it's true, protein does raise mTOR. mTOR inhibits autophagy. So the thinking is protein must be bad. And I'm not an anti-protein person at all, but I do want you to understand there was a human clinical study in individuals that had a very progressive form and an aggressive form of myopathy. So this was a disorder of the muscle tissue. And we know that autophagy is mediated and helps with muscle tissue repair in the circumstance of this myopathy. And what they had these individuals go on a very low protein diet, which was half the RDA of protein. So I want to say it was like 0.4 grams per pound or something like that of total kilograms of body weight. It was half the RDA recommendations. It was very low. And what they found at the end of the study is autophagy within the muscle tissue was elevated. So again, this is not what I personally do, but if you're trying to work with a client who maybe has dementia, Parkinson's, Huntington's, fatty liver, there could be some implications here. And I thought this was pretty interesting. At the start of this one-year study, they tracked strength, and they looked at body composition and so forth. And what they found that although these individuals lost lean body mass, their strength didn't decline on this low-protein diet. Because what they basically concluded at this is that autophagy was able to kind of like take the muscle that wasn't doing much anyway and get rid of it so that the functional muscle that was contributing to the strength was still at high levels. And I thought that was pretty fascinating. So again, this is not what I personally do. I just share with you the data. And let's see here, what else? mTOR, yeah. I do get a lot of questions about this, and this is more just for a nerdy type thing. When we're talking about mTOR, there's two different subtypes. We're mostly talking about mTOR-C1 in this context and conversation. mTOR-C2 is really involved. I kind of make the analogy mTOR-C2, and again, most of you, it doesn't even matter, but this does come up for certain people. mTOR-C2, I make the analogy that's kind of like the HOA for your cells. HOA meaning that they can, has anyone owned a condo before? Your homeowners association, like, well, if the thing burns down, we'll take care of the siding or the leaky roof and stuff, but everything on the inside is your job. So mTOR-C1 is cleaning up the cells, organelles, the proteins, everything within the cell. mTOR-C2 affects the cytoskeleton and the extracellular components. And so we see a high prevalence of mTOR-C1 activation in cancer and aberrant growth in these diseases we're talking about. Just for sake of clarity, I wanted to throw that in there. Okay, let's into another fasting study. Early time-restricted feeding. This is super controversial, is it not? Because when people are doing intermittent fasting, what's the meal they normally skip? Mm-hmm. So I've been sharing this on my Instagram, and people are like, wait. I thought we should be skipping breakfast, Mike. Why are you telling me that? And I'm like, look, you can do whatever you want. I'm just sharing with you the studies. But what we're seeing here is this group in Alabama has actually done quite a few different studies, which I think are very fascinating. So they're taking two different groups of people. They're energy balancing them and saying, you know, they're figuring out their resting metabolic rates, giving them prescribed diets. One arm of the study is just eating three meals a day, 8 a.m., noon, 6, okay? The other group is eating from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. So this is what they call early time-restricted feeding. We're going to dive into why this is important in a minute. And long story short, they looked at a bunch of different autophagy-related genes, a bunch of different epigenetic factors, a traditional anthropometric biomarkers, body fat percentage, waist-to-hip ratio, all these sort of things. And guess what? Even though the groups are consuming the total calorie count is the same in both groups, guess who benefited? The people that ate earlier in the day and started their fast earlier, okay? So what does this mean for you? Does this mean all your clients should not skip breakfast, like how they're, whatever they're currently doing? Should your clients start eating earlier? And what I like to tell people is you got to figure out if what you're doing is not working, then change it up. But if what you're doing is working, please don't change this. So for those of you that are skipping breakfast, you're having your first meal at like maybe noon or 1, and you're getting great results, you love how you feel and sleep and hormones, please don't change that. But if something's not working, consider early time-restricted feeding. Now, what I personally have found, and I struggle with the early time-restricted feeding, is I'll have all my intention of saying, okay, I'm only going to eat, you know, between 11 and, say, 4. And then my wife makes a dessert, you know, or something. I'm like, oh, here we go. I'm like, okay, I'll have it this one time, right? So, you know, she makes like some really good, you know, collagen with coconut and avocado and all this stuff. So you have to have a lot of willpower and no other distractions for early time-restricted feeding to work. Otherwise, it just becomes this long feeding window. Do you see what I'm saying? So if you have kids, if you're eating with your spouse, if they're not on the same board, then there's probably no harm in, you know, doing fasting later. Like, you don't break the fast until, say, midday, and you cut off feeding around 6 or 7. But I think the importance is just to have some regularity there. And so a subset of intermittent fasting is this element of time-restricted feeding, and it has to do with this idea of entraining our body's circadian clock system. So the reason why women menstruate at predictable intervals, the reason why men's testosterone rises in the morning, the reason why leptin rises throughout the day. Our leptin levels right now are starting to get higher and higher, okay? Our cortisol levels are doing what? They're going down as it gets closer. Adenosine is increasing, so we're getting more sleepy as the day goes on, right? All these things ebb and flow. And the innervation from your central nervous system to your GI tract is oscillating on that same circadian rhythm. And this is where I get frustrated with the calorie counters, because they're like, it doesn't matter when you eat. You can have your biggest meal at midnight and go right to bed. It's like, but your GI tract is not getting the intervention, you know, the stimulus from the central nervous system. So from an bile acid secretion, pancreatic lipase, hydrochloric acid, and GI motility is really kind of optimal between, say, 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. for most people during the day, right? And so that's why I'm not a huge fan of having people do their last or their biggest meal later in the day, just from a pure digestive circadian rhythm standpoint. Does that kind of make sense? So if people are coming to you and saying, I've been doing intermittent fasting, it's not working, then start to ask them, well, how's your digestion? Well, it's not so good. I'm constipated. I have reflux. I have all this. Well, then maybe have them do early time-restricted feeding so they can still intermittent fast, but they're adhering to their body's circadian rhythms more. What else do we have going on here? Okay, everyone wants to know, like, what happens after 72 hours, okay? When is autophagy most maximally amplified? And it turns out it is about 72 hours, which is, that can be a little extreme. For someone who's transitioning to your practice or working with you and they're new to this, telling them to fast for 3 days, they're going to be like, give me a break. I'm not doing that, right? So have them start small, right? 72 hours is like training for a marathon. You don't just go from being sedentary to running a marathon because you would get injured, unless you're David Goggins. Has anyone read David Goggins' book? Oh, you got to check it out. You Can't Hurt Me. There's some swear word and stuff in there, but it's a really motivational book. He was crazy enough to just run 100 miles with no training. Anyway, he talks about it in the book. So 72 hours is the marathon. You want to start with the 5Ks, the 10Ks, the miles, the fartleks, the pick-me-ups, and that's the 18 to 16-hour fast on a daily basis, right? And so autophagy within the skeletal muscle was increased 30%, which I know sounds kind of like, oh, dang, it's only 30%? After 3 days of no food, that's how much it was increased. I don't know, kind of disappointing, eh? Wouldn't you think it'd be like 300% or five times? You're like 30, that's it? So that's why, again, I emphasize regular physical activity because we're constantly getting that stimulus and that drive. Let's see, what else do we have here? These are just more scientific studies and things along those lines. A lot of people ask about amino acids, and what about, you know, if I take amino acids after I work out, or what about if I put a little stevia in my coffee? Will that inhibit autophagy if I'm trying to do things? And I just want to leave you, you know, with this because we're getting close on time here. Amino acids do inhibit autophagy, right? Because they affect mTOR. But you need to take this into consideration. If you're taking amino acids after a very hard workout and you're going to be sore the next day, taking those amino acids will help to delay that delayed onset muscle soreness and enhance your recovery, right? So it's kind of a trade-off. If you're doing nothing and sitting on your butt, you don't need a lot of branched-chain amino acids. If you're doing nothing and sitting on your butt, having a bunch of stevia and a bunch of junk in your coffee, you might be shortchanging your autophagy mechanisms. But if you're moving, you're physically active, you're doing everything else right, it's probably not going to, you know, be a major factor. Do you guys, I get these questions, someone asked it, bless their heart. They said, hey, Mike, if I brush my teeth with toothpaste, will that inhibit autophagy? I'm like, well, are you swallowing the toothpaste? I mean, what are you doing with your toothpaste? But we do need to understand that this, here's the reason why I'm telling you this, the so-called cephalic phase of digestion, okay? So if I were to start cooking, you know, I don't know, maybe a curry right now, and you could smell the onions and the curry cooking, guess what's going to happen? Your body, you're going to start to get hungry, right? Even if you're not hungry. Maybe even just me telling you that, you started to visualize, you're like, oh man, that sounds good right now. Guess what's going to happen? There's this cephalic phase of insulin being released during that anticipation of food. The body is always trying to maintain homeostasis. Even though we need food for energy, eating is actually very disruptive from a homeostatic standpoint, is it not? Glucose goes up. The body's like, whoa, glucose, what are you doing? So then insulin needs to rise. So there's all this going on. And so when we start anticipating food, when we get hungry, your body is releasing insulin because it thinks you're going to start eating, okay? And I say that because if your clients are putting a bunch of stevia and non-nutritive sweeteners in their coffee and things like that, you could be sending the message to the brain and there could be a mild insulin release. Now, if they're getting the results that they want, then it's probably no big deal. But if they're not getting the results, then we need to reconsider these synthetic and non-nutritive sweeteners because of the potential cephalic phase of digestion. And animal models, we're like big Pavlov dogs, right? And this is the other thing you need, this is the take-home point number 7, I think we're on now, is intermittent fasting can be challenging for people initially because they're going to say, you ask them, when do you normally eat breakfast? Most people say, right before I go to work, I make a protein shake or I do this or that, right? So every day their body is anticipating that from a circadian rhythm standpoint, right? And when you take that away, they're going to be hungry. They're going to realize, they're going to think, how can I ever fast? Like, this is so hard. I don't know how you do it. You did 72 hours? Like, you're Superman. It's like, no, really, you've kind of desensitized your circadian rhythm by starting to fast. And remember the first time any of you fasted, it was really hard. I never thought I could fast for 24 hours, 72 hours, right? Because I was so used to this. And so you need to break that cephalic phase and that anticipation in your clients or yourselves when you start fasting. So it's normal to be hungry. It might be normal to be a little bit shaky around mealtime because of that cephalic phase of digestion, right? A little pre-meal insulin rise, but there's no meal. Guess what happens to glucose? It's going to drop. And then people are going to be shaky and lethargic and like, oh my gosh, fasting didn't work for me. It doesn't work. Let's say just give it time. It's the first time because of anticipation. So we can go on and on. You all have access to this PDF. The good and bad news is we don't have great biomarkers at this time to look at autophagy because it's occurring inside our cells, and it's really hard to peek in there and see exactly what's going on. So we have to triangulate using glucose, using hormones, using body fat, using brain function, using vitality as subjective markers. Here's a bunch of different things about the summary of autophagy. If you'd like a picture, even though you get the PDF. And here's the thing that I personally do, and this is going to be the last slide. And so some element of time-restricted feeding and or intermittent fasting pretty much every single day I think is very, very helpful. Again, if it's early eating earlier in the day and fasting earlier, if that works for you, fantastic. If you don't eat your first meal till 2 p.m. or you do one meal a day, whatever works for you is phenomenal. I recommend physical activity of all kinds, okay? You can lift weights, you can do yoga, you can walk, you can hike, you can ride your bike, you can play with your kids, you can garden. Whatever it is that moves your lymph, that moves your muscles is going to be beneficial. Of course, you can do all this without supplements, but supplements can really help. I was so blown away, using fish oil and berberine with my continuous glucose monitor. It was impressive how it just dropped that glucose down and shot the ketones up. And I think this is working on the autophagy mechanisms, and there's some research to support that. RAPA, that's short for rapamycin. Okay, if I'm trying to convince my dad, who's kind of a more allopathic, bless his heart, he's more allopathic, and it's hard for him to totally trust what I say, but there's this doctor in New York that does rapamycin treatment to slow down mild cognitive impairment, because I've noticed, his mother had dementia, and his father had congestive heart failure, and I really want to help him live a long life, and I think, micro-dosing rapamycin for older Linda, you wouldn't want to do this for a bodybuilder, right? Because you're kind of it would slow down potentially the muscle gain. But rapamycin could be something that to look at. Some people are kind of anti-drug. I think metformin is a drug that is used for the treatment of diabetes. There are some benefits of metformin as well. Minimal side effects, small B12 and folate inhibition. Mushrooms. I'm a huge fan of mushrooms. And here's the cool thing about mushrooms. They contain this compound called spermidine, which activates autophagy. Whole grains also contain spermidine, but I can't recommend you eat whole grains. So mushrooms. And guess what? When are mushrooms in season? Right now in the fall. So your clients, here's how you can get your activity. Here's how you can get your sunlight. Here's how you can forest bathe and do all the Shenron Roku, is go in the forest with your kids, your family, and look for mushrooms after it rains. It is so fun. And there's a bunch of books that can, help guide you. And actually, in this part of the country, I think reishi grows and is endemic. You can find lion's mane. It's been something that in the last couple of years we do, and it seems scary at first. You're like, I don't know if I want to eat that. But once you learn to identify these things, they're free. Because if you pay for shiitake mushrooms or chanterelle mushrooms, it's crazy. It's exorbitant, $20 a pound at the grocery store. You're like, why would I pay for that if I can go in the forest and find it? So, and lastly, we didn't really talk about circadian rhythms too much, but remember that autophagy is influenced by your circadian clock genes in the morning, and when you're sleeping is when it's most activated, okay? And I think that's pretty much it. I'm grateful for your time. Hopefully you learned a thing or two, a nugget or two. I have this final slide that'll just show you if you want to connect. Maybe it's not going there. Oh. Here we go. So if you like this presentation and you want to connect, I'm on social. I'm on Instagram. I'm on YouTube. I'm on Facebook. If you have any questions, just DM me. Let me know. We have a lot of seminars and online workshops and videos that you might be of interest. And I'm very grateful that you were here. And I'll say after if you have any questions. So thanks for tuning in.